Hi everyone, welcome back to the Godel Pod. I'm Michael Hammond, Client Director here at Godel, and today I'm joined by Damien Ryan, currently Managing Director at Comore. Thanks very much for joining us, Damien. How are you?
I'm doing really good, apart from this heat.
Yes.
It's taken about 7 hours before I went from complaining about the cold to complaining about the heat.
It wouldn't be very British of us if we didn't mention the weather straight away and the fact that it's warm. So great. Yeah, it's nice to have a bit of sunshine, but it's been a little bit too warm of late. Obviously, we're not here to talk about the weather, Damien, but basically, I think the best way for us to go today, we're going to do a bit of a talk about the psychology of development. Obviously, a very broad subject, but your experience of this, and you've got a very illustrious history in the software development, lots of different roles. But I think what we'd love to do is start at the beginning. And if you could tell us where you initially got into the world of computer science and software development, where your love came from and where it all started, I think that'd be a good place for us to kick it off.
Right, so we're going back to the Stone Ages then. when I was thinking about university, about where I wanted to go, what I actually wanted to be was a scientist.
Right, okay.
So I went to the Dublin Institute of Technology, which was, it started off as a technical college years ago, but then gradually, built up degree programs. And it was a place where someone from a working class background who could actually go and get an affordable education in tertiary education. And they ran this course in conjunction with Trinity College Dublin called Applied Science. Right. And really what that course was is trying to develop scientists who were purely theoretical. They knew how the real world worked and how the sorts of shapes of people that companies wanted. As part of this, they did physics, chemistry, all the other things. Then they had computer science and software engineering as options. Played video games all my life. I had the computer since I was nine.
Oh, something we've got in common already.
Shock, I know, for someone of my shape. The computer science as part of that. And that's where my brain kind of went, I didn't have to do the really, really hard maths that physics needed. And don't even get me started on double integrations. I still don't understand it. But I could actually, sit down at a machine, type something in, and it did exactly what I wanted, whether it was right or not. But it did that. So I got solved.
I mean, everyone's got to understand the level of satisfaction there from that. I mean, I remember it from a young age, starting at a computer and just making a machine go 5 meters forward, turn left, very basic
circle,
stuff that
you did.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so that's that was, I mean, if that didn't excite you as a young lad, then I didn't know what did.
Then graduated from there, 1998, which, yes, the last century, I know. And at the time, around then, just before that, there's just at the edge of when the internet bubble and the web bubble was starting to come up. So I thought, coming out, get a job in a manufacturing plant, writing database queries for the rest of my life would be nice, easy job.
Yeah.
Things exploded. So I went to work for a company called Iona, which very few people will remember. But they were an Irish company who floated on the Nasdaq Stock Exchange, and they were a huge success story at the time. And what they built was a CORBA object request broker and a framework for building distributed applications, which everyone does now. But at the time, there was no other way of doing this.
Yeah.
And to go back to that, I remember talking to a colleague a few years ago, talking about this and where I started.
Yeah.
The guy turned around to me and said, yeah, I remember CORBA from history of computing class.
Wow.
And that's when I thought,
that's where the name came from.
Yeah.
Is this early 2000s then, Damien?
So this is, yeah, late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay.
So development at the time was really, we had version control, but it was way before Git. You know, it was even before Subversion and all of those things.
Using
a thing called Clearcase. It was very complicated to get code into, you know, a big code base.
Yeah.
And it took a lot of work to get the right patches out to customers. We actually, you know, you think about DevOps now, where you can deploy hundreds of times a day to get a patch out to a customer. We built it on a single machine, zipped the files up, and emailed those files over to a customer who had to unzip them on their end and hope for the best.
Yeah, it's when you paint it like that, you realize really how far we have come. I mean, I know there's obvious things that we look at around just your house to see how far we've come. But, you know, when you think about the actual developers behind the scenes who are actually working on all these things, what they, how differently they had to do it. Goodness me.
So it was then it was at, so as well, I mean, there's none of this agile stuff. It was all, everything was either waterfall or it was, you know, a bunch of developers hoping for the best to get some software out the door.
Yeah.
Towards the end of my tour there, then we're getting into the early 2000s. Still a baby developer, not really understanding a lot of how everything works. But Iona brought this fella over from the US called Kent Beck. None of us have ever heard of him. Name's probably familiar to yourself. But he came over and told us about this thing called XP, where you actually ask the customers what they want. And do what the customers want, which set off fireworks in my head. Like, that's why we're here. Right. Okay.
I like that.
So then around the start of the 21st century, yikes, the dot-com bubble burst and a whole lot of companies, especially the ones that are reliant on US money, went bust. There's going to be a theme here. I was one of the people laid off from Iona at the time.
Right.
And then I did what most Irish people do, is look to England. And I'll come over to Cambridge for, you know, 6 months, see how it goes. So I got a job in a company called Accelerus. And they did scientific modeling software on desktop, which communicated with servers, so kind of fit in well. That was 20 years ago. So there's something about Cambridge and the ecosystem around Cambridge that just really holds on to you. It's a really nice place to live.
Yeah, absolutely. Having
on London doorstep. And it's around that time where I realised that I'm not the sort of person who likes to go in and, you know, tinker on the very edges of something and really get, you know, good at one specific thing.
Yeah.
And it's more about the how we make software and how we help developers, you know, actually be effective at what they do rather than having to work through heroics.
We're already seeing a sort of a change in your psychology as a developer, aren't we, as you've moved around. So yeah, you can, it would you say from, you know, it's well, you've had a few sort of penny drop moments already in your first two places. Is that a constant thing that you've found through psychology in development, that you're always learning, you're always having these? Obviously at the start of your career you're going to have a lot more, but would you say there's that spike at the start of your career where you seem to be taking on a lot and having a lot of changes in how you see it and what, I mean, you mentioned it, why you're actually doing it in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, it's, if you, I'm going to try and, I don't have a whiteboard here, so it's going to be difficult, but if you can try and imagine like a graph. And you think about learning, it always feels like it's a linear graph going up until you've learned everything and then tapers off. But what it really is kind of a series of bursts. So, like you said, you've got that really fast ramp up in uni where you're trying to learn what the hell this programming thing is. And then that tapers off where you think you've got it. And then you go into a job with real people having to learn to work together and learn soft skills. And there's another big ramp up of learning happens again.
Yeah.
Which starts tapering off. and then discover, well, it's all about customer value. There's a whole other bunch of things to learn, and it's kind of this step thing that keeps happening.
Yeah, I'm
all the way
you.
Through my
yeah.
career, and even now, there's whole. Yeah. There's, you'll never know everything, but you know, just find something that will grab you and say, "Wait, this is where I want to learn that."
I'm with you. Are we mid 2000s? Is that
so
right?
So now we're early to late 2000s.
Okay.
So 2001, 2008, that sort of time frame. Things are still fairly old-fashioned. But instead of sending zip files with libraries and executables around, we have installer programs that you can double-click the installer. It will do all of the work for you. And
that's
this
right,
is where, like, thinking about automation and thinking about doing taking the toil out of work, which is what fired me up then.
Mm.
It feels like sometimes, and dichotomies I know are usually false, but it feels like they're kind of two types of developers here, or developer psychologies. There's the developer who wants to make new features, who wants to, you know, explore new tech and all of that. And then there's the type of developer who wants to make the process of getting stuff to customers out the door as easy as possible.
Yeah.
And it's very integration of, at the time, was build teams and build engineering or tools engineering, which has, you know, slowly become DevOps over the last 20 years now.
Yeah. It's interesting, is it, how that mindset shapes your career in software development, what angle software engineering, what you go into, whether you're that proactive person that wants to create new things or whether you like fixing things. It's how do you think that's something that is decided early on, or does it change often?
I'm not sure how stable it is. So you stable, it's kind of a psychological term, which means, you know, whether a trait lasts for, you know, a lifetime or it does change. But I have noticed that there are kind of the people who want to work on new fancy features and tech kind of complain quite a lot when you ask them to do some bug fixing or, you know, some deep refactoring or changes to code that aren't going to make it out the door to customers. So automation around build frameworks. But that has changed quite a lot with the advent of DevOps. So pushing these kind of skills together and the advent of, you know, agile ways of forming teams, so cross-functional teams, where gradually we're getting developers to see that it's not a personal sport. It's a team sport, and it's about what the team can do.
Yeah, no I in team, right?
Yeah.
No, that's it's a really good point. I mean, and that's in all walks of life, really, I think, with any organization or anything you're trying to do. How does the psychology of development affect developers' work as individuals and as a team? So, you know, is there that fear to fail, fear to share with the team, success as a team as opposed to an individual? How does that differ?
Oh, if you're going from, so back to kind of the story, I kind of started going from older style companies, like you could almost say, you know, pre-Agile Manifesto to later stage companies which came after that, and then DevOps similarly following along. I've seen developers are either, you know, they want to work in a team and they need to work in a team, which, you know, that's the prevailing wisdom. That's what we have to do now.
Yeah.
There are still some developers who never want to do that and think we shouldn't talk to each other. And that's a really hard thing as well, because we're never taught soft skills growing up.
Yeah.
We're taught languages, we're taught design patterns. But those things are easy to learn. What's really hard to learn is the, how do you have a conversation without knowing someone, or how do you foster a sense of collaboration and safety in a team?
Yeah.
And that's the important thing, because you can have the best programmers in the world if they're not talking to each other, or if they feel that, you know, their ideas will get knocked down, or if there's lots of competition. And you just have to look at Twitter at the moment. They're not going to be as effective as possible.
Yeah. That's a really, really, really good point. I mean, communication, absolutely on point, and working in teams and things like that. It's having your point heard, being able to effectively communicate that. I know we've spoke before about it, kind versus nice. Tell the viewers what you mean. So viewers, listeners, we're on a podcast, aren't we? We're not streaming live. tell the listeners what you mean versus when you say kind versus nice.
So a lot of people, when they hear the word kind, I think, actually, hang on, let me turn this around. I'll put a pause in there, actually. What do you think if someone is being kind? What does that suggest to you?
If someone's being kind, they are buying someone an ice cream, being polite, please and thank yous. Am I way off there?
Yeah, that is particularly what nice is. And nice is kind of pushing things down just to get along.
So yeah,
you might feel conflict. You might not agree with someone, but you don't want to be mean, so you're just going along with it. Kind is, it's a little bit sharper.
Yeah,
it's all the things. You know, it's helping your colleagues be the best they can be, working out. You know, actually pointing out good things as they go along, but also pointing out bad things. So
sure, yeah,
if you've got conflict, you know, and you want to have this conversation, it's kinder to have a difficult conversation and, you know, get that out in the open, or kind of give difficult feedback. But the kind bit is doing it in this kind of, it's not cruel to be kind, it's doing it in this human manner.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are ways of giving feedback that aren't cruel.
Sure.
But aren't nice.
So there's, basically it's a clear, concise conversation. Not cruel, but it's for the good of the team, and it's constructive. Constructive, isn't it? I guess is perhaps the word, but sounds like all teams should be doing it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you've seen Ted Lasso. Yeah, it's been kind of a big thing over the last, especially during lockdown. But the evolution of that character, you know, it starts off as someone who's very nice, but to the point where it almost killed him.
Yeah,
and
then
moves across where he gets therapy and thumbs up for therapy. That's... Everyone should do it.
Yeah,
and then
absolutely,
he starts being more kind. He's looking after himself. He's giving people the hard feedback that they need. He's not just hoping everything just gets along. And that's the journey that we all have to take.
Yeah, no, I think that's if anyone has watched it, they'll completely understand. And that's the perfect sort of example there, isn't it? It's an interesting conversation, kind versus nice, because unless someone's had that conversation, I don't think they understand. So it's being nice, actually, in the long run, is actually can be detrimental. You want to be kind. That's really good. Do you think that has become more difficult with the modern ways of working, Damien? Obviously, is it easier to be kind face to face than it is over a Teams call? What effect has the modern way of working had on our psychology, do you think, and perhaps specifically for software developers, of course?
So back to the personal story. Lockdown absolutely broke me. So again, you can imagine, thinking about no software engineering science background, developing before moving into management, I thought I would love being locked in the house, not having to do meetings, not having to make small talk, all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So it took 2 weeks before I was almost screaming, wanting to go back into an office. And I know this is a very personal thing before the people with the pitchforks come after me. I discovered I was an extrovert, or at least an ambivert, sometime, 2 weeks into lockdown. One of the biggest things I noticed for me during lockdown was that Zoom and online calls, all of this stuff, made everything very two-dimensional. So that we didn't do the small talk or the how are you today, that sort of thing. Meetings were very much,
literally 2D, wasn't it? It was,
and
and
we're not going to learn about each other.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's completely true. I mean, I've worked from home for a long time as well, and being perhaps what I'd say is more of a people person, the time you spend in an office, you know, you'll have conversations you wouldn't have. You just, I know it sounds obvious, but getting someone a coffee, walking past someone's desk, just catching eyes with someone at the office, I need to do this for you, or things like that. You know, if you're not hot on your reminders on your laptop, it's just invaluable, really, isn't it, that time in the office?
Yeah. And psychology wise, it took us a long time to actually understand that people on the screen were people. We've spent all of our lives being primed that a person is three-dimensional in front of you. You can see their body language. You can see the subtle, you know, facial expressions. When someone is just shoulders and a head on a flat screen, we've been primed, you know, through video games, through television, that they're not people. You know, they're someone on the screen. And we switched into that mode without knowing it. I think there was almost like a desert of empathy at the time, where we were all a little bit more ratty with each other. We all demanded a lot more of each other and didn't spend the time to, you know, see where we all okay. And then while the productivity of individuals went up, the effectiveness of a team went down because we lost that psychological safety. We lost the ability to make mistakes.
Yeah, I think there's a right way of perhaps working remotely, and there's a wrong way. I think you can't just do it. You've got to have certain things, certain support, people support set up there. You know, you've got to have regular check-ins and things like that to help with that. The psychological struggle through essentially just being on your own and, like you say, not having that human contact. It's interesting you said we have kind of been tuned to think that someone on a screen isn't real, or there's not that, you know, from watching TV and playing computer games and stuff like that. If it's on the TV, you don't have that. It's just not the same, is it? You don't have those body languages coming back at you. You know, it's head and shoulders. That's all it is on a screen. Interesting that you said productivity went up. And why do you think that was then?
So it's a very specific type of productivity, though. The productivity of a person went up because you're at home all day. There are fewer interruptions. If someone wants to just have a chat, it's a big thing. You have to go and put something in the diary, or you have to call them on Slack or Zoom. You have the conversation. You have to think about why you're having the conversation, as opposed to just dropping by someone's desk saying, "Hey, how are you doing? You're not looking, you're not looking great. Is there anything you're happy with?" But you have all of that extra time to do the bits of work that are just work.
Yeah. So it's not that often you get a sort of an invite in your Outlook calendar to talk about the football or stuff like that. But, you know, because you might think that that's not right, but realistically in the office you will do that. You'll have a chat about your weekend, the football, good or bad, and it'll be invaluable. But you just like say when you're at home, you don't have those calendar invites for that.
And we tried really hard at the start of lockdown, if you remember that time. There was a lot of we're going to do all the same things, we're going to have social time on Zoom,
the quizzes,
it was just reminding me that it wasn't good enough.
I know, I understand. It's we did try. I guess it's all about that hybrid now, really, having a bit of a mix of both. And I think that has come from feedback from it, you know, one way at remote, just it doesn't work as quite way. Got to have that bit of the blend.
It's also very personal. So the way I'm talking about myself, I know I'm in the minority, the person who wants to be in the office and around people, especially in development. You know, that sort of, I'm the person in the minority there. But so is the I never want to talk to people. And there's always something in between. So it is up to the person which, you know, which way they want to live their life.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's nothing more personal, is there, than your psychology, how you feel, how you react. So it's not a one blanket fits all, although there might be things out there that ring true for a lot of people. There's nothing more personal, really. Mm. I mean, like you say, like some people during lockdown had the time of their life. They loved it, you know. It's interesting. So I guess moving away from sort of remote working and how that affected us, what would you say are the three most important points or three most important psychological traits for a successful developer? Or we could do five. How many would you like to do?
So we're all individuals. Mm. And I don't really think that there are specific traits that mean you're going to be a good developer or not. But sure. There are some behaviors that will help you a lot. Biggest one is going to be curiosity. Mm. I'm going to say the same for most, you know, knowledge roles. Curiosity is your biggest friend.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
You need to be curious about the customer problem, what they actually want to be fixed, you know, what is going to help people. Then curious
understand
how you're going to fix it and how you're going to make it better. But not just do the kind of the smallest thing that would solve that problem, but think wider about the issues that will come up around there. So what the wider systems is going to integrate with. I think that's probably your biggest trait.
Very, very true. Obviously, understanding a problem outside in is very difficult. And then sometimes, you know, if you're limited to three questions, you're not going to have the same overview. I like to see it as a bit of a jigsaw. So if you ask 20 questions, you'll have more pieces there, so it's easier. Mm. If you ask two questions or they're not the right questions, then and you're not curious enough to ask them in the first place, then you're going to have maybe three or four outside pieces and you're not going to know how to work on it. Would you go along with my little idea of a jigsaw? I've always used that.
Yeah, I like that.
Obviously,
you're always going to be wrong, but the more curious you are at the start, the less likely that wrong is going to be.
Yeah. And I mean, in software development, I would imagine it's even more important because they're not always visual things. And, you know, if you're talking about like a monolith system, you might not necessarily even know until you've been curious enough to test something, right? Mm. Bit of manual testing there, and you might, curiosity, I think, is, that's a really good point.
And it goes beyond just finding out what the customer wants. Your customer wants a certain piece of business, functionality. Mm. You need to be curious about the entire system and how it interacts with other things to learn the parts that the customer never knows they want. But if you don't do them, you won't help that problem.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, so Damien, carry on with your journey in software engineering and how it shaped you today.
Yeah, so then Accelerus, again, much more about developer experience, building tools to help them get software in effectively. And I was about halfway through kind of career at the time, starting to feel a little bit burnt out. Probably if you're a developer and you haven't felt coming close to burnout at some time, then you're rare and incredibly lucky. I have a very weird reaction to burnout. Mm. And what I did was sign up for an Open University course, not realizing just how much work it was going to be. So then around the end of my time at Accelerus, I took on a psychology master's with the Open University and spent about 10 years getting that at the same time working. And then after Accelerus, I went to a small company that you might have heard of. They used to make mobile phones, Motorola.
Motorola. No, I never heard of them. Yeah, of course we have. Huge conglomerate.
Yeah. And that was a huge step up in learning about software development at scale. So most of the companies I worked for had about 200 odd developers. Motorola at that time had 77,000 developers.
Wow.
I was working for a very small part of it, which was basically trying to build Android before Android came out.
Okay. Interesting.
And that was a very different way of doing software. It's kind of, at that point then, I mean, all the agile side of things vanished because you're talking about hardware, still very old school.
Embedded stuff.
Embedded processes. So building where we were, building the OS framework and the OS for a phone. That had to go through various regulatory checks. For some, I discovered as an engineer that there were regulations in some parts of the industry. And then that went to device manufacturers, had to certify it there, and then network owners had to certify it there. So that was a lot slower process, but then learning to work with hardware and lots more developers, that was an interesting time.
Right. Slightly different to what you'd previously been doing in terms of that. Was that a valuable part, a valuable learning curve, I would say, through Motorola?
This is where I actually learned a lot more doing a psychology degree than I ever did doing computer science. Because if you think about the scales of people, so in the Cambridge site, there were 400 people. That's a lot harder for any one person to know what any one other person does.
Sure.
So trying to, get that entire system in your head is very hard. And where I was working on the build team was very much, I had to understand all of the different teams and who was fighting with whom, and who was happy, who wasn't, what parts of the system were less good than others. That's a learning about development as a psychology game as opposed to building.
And I guess if you've got that level of communication or if psychological understanding, you could learn about the pros and cons a lot quicker through talking through the team rather than just sitting down on your own going through lines and lines of code. And it does benefit the industry massively,
especially for a team for a company that size. One person changing something deep in an operating system has massive ramifications for everyone else. So you have to talk. You have to figure out, if I'm changing the Bluetooth stack, how's that going to affect everything else about the phone? Okay, I need to get drivers updated and have to talk to the drivers team. And this is probably hint at this now, but this is where later on, much smarter people than me, I come up with team topologies and talk about, hey, we've been told silos are bad for 20 years. But actually, if you want to be a human being and able to reason about this stuff, you have to have some sorts of silos.
Okay, interesting. So how long were you at Motorola for then, Damien? Was that a long stint?
20 years. Wasn't a massive stint. The iPhone came out, Android came out, and the market changed sufficiently that, unfortunately, I don't think Motorola kept up with the times.
Yeah, right.
They closed their Cambridge office, and that's when I moved down to London.
Okay.
Worked for a few years for this web thing that was starting to get big again. We never worked on a web app before. So I worked for a company called Bordex at the time, and they built relationship capital management software. So again, looking at the relationships between people and how you can leverage them and the strength of those relationships.
Sure.
And that was a huge change from Motorola, because it went from huge development teams worldwide to a very small team of 6 people.
Okay.
And they worked proper Scrum. And this is one of the dangers of Scrum I've seen, that it becomes very easy, especially if you're a developer, to look at the things that Scrum or a framework says you have to do. And then do that alone, as opposed to understanding, you know, what they're there for.
Okay.
So, for example, there's one piece of work I was working on the installer.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're supposed to make progress every sprint, it became busy work because, you know, if you did the installer at the end and everything worked then, it's a lot easier than, you know, completely reworking the installer every week just to make progress.
I see. Yeah, yeah.
So there was a bit of tension there between me and the development manager on whether, you know, I should just spend my time making slow progress. And incremental progress is good, but sometimes, you know, it's a tension between avoiding rework and avoiding not making progress until the very end.
Yeah, so that's a good mix, isn't it, between methodologies and psychology. And you've got to take into account both equally, I would imagine.
And one thing I noticed there actually was this was just before DevOps became a thing.
Right.
And the operations team and development team didn't talk very well. And I was kind of in between both. But the operations team would complain about this Scrum thing.
Mm-hmm.
And like things like, oh yeah, they're just doing process for process sake and all of this, you know, it's not very stable. And development team would obviously complain about the operations team about, oh, they're setting their ways, why can't they just make a change, you know? And then, you know, DevOps started coming out, people were writing about it, and gradually they started to come together. It was great being able to see that, but it took a lot of trying to get each kind of side of the business to understand the other side's problems and why they're thinking that way, rather than, you know, saying they're wrong because obviously I'm right.
There's an element of empathy that we're touching on there, I think, which is something we've...
the hardest part, isn't it? Understanding that. So there's a thing I know occasionally, it's called the liking gap.
Okay.
So basically, as humans, we spend all of our time in our own head. So we've got this one voice that's constant, that's always here.
Yeah.
What we don't understand a lot of the time on a very visceral level is that other people don't have access to that voice. So we assume they know this constant stream of thoughts that's always here.
They
don't.
We often think that we are, we assume other people are mind readers, when
exactly,
unfortunately
yeah.
that doesn't exist.
If only we could, yeah.
I know. But yeah, that's a good point. Obviously, it's a psychological understanding, isn't it, that you need to communicate your thoughts and other people will have other thoughts and trying to work together and understand why somebody else has done something.
Yeah. And then, you know, understanding the grace and kindness that, you know, you'll have a lot of time where it takes a long time to build up this kind of ability to have conversations that you know are going to be tricky. But the conversations are important because that's how you build an understanding of the other person's world.
Yeah, so it sounds like at this point in your career, you're starting to understand a bit about like the leadership, what things work. Like you've got this Scrum, you've done Waterfall, DevOps is on the brink. So would you say this is quite a you know, like when we were talking about the graph and how you learn
this
and in
another one of these quantum jumps.
It sounds like you're about, you know, yeah, about there. So. So where did it lead you next, Damien?
The next, I moved back to Cambridge. I moved companies back to Cambridge because I wanted to stop teaching for a while. It was back and forth 6 hours a day on the train.
Blimey, yeah.
So you can imagine if I was that person during lockdown, I probably would have been a lot more happy.
Yes, yeah. Very individual, like we said, yeah.
Yeah. And started working for a security software company called Bromium.
Right.
That's where I started leading a team and started building more around the process and actually taking a smaller company to the point where it needs to be.
Okay.
That, again, that was about bringing in DevOps practices, about reducing how often, reducing the time between releases, getting customer value early and often.
So you'd completed your psychology masters at this point. Is that right?
I did actually. Yeah. So yeah. I was about 2 years into Bromium when I'd finally written up and
10,000 words.
Yeah. and then for 2 minutes, I think at most, thought about a doctorate and thought, no, I don't have any more hair left. I can't do that. Yeah.
It was a similar thought process for myself. I did. I've got a master's in town planning, and I think I thought about it probably about a minute and a half. I thought, I think I'm there. Education wise, I think I'm happy. But so then, that must have been. You must have been able to take so much from that master's degree and implement it into running the teams. It sounds like it all came together at a really, really good time. It must have helped you with your career quite a lot.
Yeah. So then after Bromium, I moved over to Featurespace.
Right.
Because I was employee number 87 when I joined there. So it was a small engineering team, 30 people, but growing really, really quickly.
Scaling up. Yeah. Yeah.
With lots of great technical people, but not a lot of process. So I came in to do the process management and kind of take some of the things I'd learned previously and introduce them to a company that's growing far too quickly. And I spent my time there kind of growing the team from that 30 people team to 120.
Wow.
Building the leadership team, building communication processes, and basically trying to instill that kind, empathetic, we want team first culture across the company. And this is around the biggest thing there. So one of my big projects was actually taking the organization. So it's like development, but for people and structures.
Right, yeah.
Taking the organization to a place that would support
less code, more people.
Turning Outlook and PowerPoint into my IDE.
Right.
So this is around the time I've kind of hinted at it before as team topologies came out.
Okay.
And there's nothing majorly new in team topologies, but what it does is it brings together 20 years of thought and practice into a fairly slender book, but it's all gold about how you organize teams, different types of teams that you would organize people in, and how you organize people to allow as much trust as possible.
Sure.
So if you think about the connections between people, so if you've got two people in a team, you only have to have one conversation to kind of figure something out.
Yeah.
If you've got four people in the team, you have to have eight conversations going across.
Yeah.
And scaling like that. As soon as you've got a single team over five or six people, then to have trust in that team of people becomes incredibly difficult because you have to constantly have these conversations. And that's why we organize into teams.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then the key things around team topologies is you organize the teams around very specific parts of your software architecture. So then that team can do everything it needs to do around that piece of the system.
Right.
And then you do actually put silos in between teams. So there's a great concept in there called the team API, which is where you describe, when you have a team, you describe how you contact the team, the parts of the system they are responsible for, the APIs, the technical APIs that they use. And if you're changing a part of the system that might affect that, what those are. And the other information, basically you have, that's how you communicate with the team.
Brilliant.
So then you're taking the individuals, you're taking the whole, I'm an individual, do my job piece up a level. In that the units of the organization are really teams. and the teams then talk to each other through these interfaces.
Yeah. Would you say that's a challenge faced by a lot of companies out there? Would you say that's implemented quite broadly, or would you say it's something that a lot of companies could take into context and try and apply?
Oh, it's if you look at some of the stuff that Matt Skelton and Emmanuel Pei have been writing recently, it's gone way outside of technical teams.
Yeah.
And companies of any type of business are starting to implement these sorts of ideas.
Basically,
you know, laying out who's responsible for what.
Yeah.
And how those people interact.
There's additional layers of governance. I think that perhaps the best way to say it, that is needed around these teams. The G word, yeah. But it's important, isn't it?
There's a key piece. Everyone sort of, especially with the agile kind of movement, everyone talks about empowered teams. But empowerment on its own can create chaos. It's like, well, this is my piece. You can't have it. And people are fighting over ownership of code or this is my process. The team topologies kind of framework gives you more of a way of laying out the boundaries of this empowerment. And boundaries are super, super empowering.
Yeah.
Because the constraints are what allow you then to go off and do whatever you need to do within those boundaries.
Sure. Yeah. The rules are there for a reason, sort of thing, isn't it? How could we help or encourage people to understand the importance of this psychology aspect? Because let's be honest, Damon, there's not too many guys in your industry that have this level of understanding of psychology, with a master's degree in psychology. What a fantastic mix. It's almost, I think, everyone should have some sort of education in psychology. For all lines of work, right? Let's not pretend it's not. But my girlfriend has a bachelor's degree in psychology, and often I'll run things past her and she just views it completely different to me. And I'm like, oh God, you're so right. How can we better understand the psychology of a software developer? It is critical to their success, right? By understanding thought processes and the motivation of someone behind why they're doing what they're doing, it can change, right?
Probably shouldn't say this, but there's nothing actually special about software developers as people. You understand the psychology of the individual rather than software developers are all this stereotype that you've got.
Yeah. I mean, there's stereotypes for all types of people, right? Salesmen, you know, salespeople are they're the guys in the suit that won't let you speak. They'll won't leave you alone. They'll hassle you on the phone. That's the stereotypical salesman, right? Egotistical, flashy car. But realistically, most of us aren't. I mean, there's all that. And in software development, I guess there's that picture that people paint. But yeah, go on. So
there are traits, you know. And like you said, they're stereotypes for a reason. But most of developers, at least that I've known, want to fix things. They want to solve problems for real people. That's why they're there. And this can be great, because you're solving real business problems, you're saving companies money, you're stopping real people from being defrauded, you're making all these cool things that we've got to play with.
Absolutely.
It can also have a dark side, in that the first thing most developers will do is try to fix a problem rather than pause and try to consider, well, what are we trying to do here?
Why is the problem there in the first place?
Is there something else we can do about that rather than making a code change? Or is it what the customer actually wants? You know, there's all sorts of questions that you can ask before jumping straight to, I'm going to make an early code fix late at night and hope.
Are we trying to fix something that doesn't need fixing? You know, there's sometimes that question, is it? Yeah, it, you really got it. It's that, that inquisitiveness and that we spoke about earlier, you know, curiosity.
That's the key thing,
yeah.
And the downside as well for a lot of developers is that when code bases get too creaky, when there's a lot of pressure from a business to do lots of little things and do too much, that as development teams feel like they're not providing value. Developers in those teams are very hard on themselves.
Are we touching on imposter syndrome maybe as well here? I think
syndrome, burnout, stress, all of these things not being able to do the one thing that you think you're great at.
So I guess what we're touching on so many interesting points here, Damien. What can we do to help perhaps spread the word and better understand the psychology of a software developer besides picking up a book or doing a psychology degree?
there's a lot you don't even need to learn. It's all about communication, talking to your colleagues, and setting aside your own thoughts and actually truly listening. None of us actually really listens. When I'm talking right now, I bet you that you're sitting thinking about what's the next question you're going to be saying.
Of course,
you're human. But that's what we all do, which means that we're either waiting to knock down a point, or we're just not present. We're not truly kind of trying to understand what that person is trying to say. And it's rarely it's the words that the person is trying to say. There's always something behind there, and you can dig into it and figure that out.
Would you agree? I mean, I'm 33. Okay, so I'm getting to a point in my life where perhaps I can look back at myself 10, 15 years ago and think, God, like for me, that the listening aspect. I remember when I first sort of started in sales. You know, it was very much what you just said, like not listening, thinking of what next to say, whereas as I've got older, a bit more calm, you know, there's nothing wrong with being open, honest. You know, we are all human. If I was to say, if you'd said something when I was younger, if someone had said something I didn't understand, I would nod and pretend to understand, save my grace sort of thing. But as I got older, but actually, there's absolutely nothing wrong with me saying, sorry. I mean, even if I'm the only one in the room, I don't understand. Can you explain it? Until I do. And then my word, that is an important aspect to have, that open, clear communication, like you said. If you can have that, then there's nothing, like you said, the technical point of view you get from your university degrees, you get your technical understanding. But if you can't ask that question, if there's something you don't understand, then my word is it going to be difficult?
All sorts of reasons why you wouldn't ask a question. So I don't want to feel look like I'm stupid, or even worse, if teams don't have that safety, you could get shouted at for asking a question. It's fostering that environment, and they're going really hard on you. Reward people not just for technical excellence, but also for communication and collaboration.
That's a prime example of where psychology can hinder development, full stop, any sort of progress. You know, if someone's scared to ask questions, and that just proves sort of your point that psychology and the psychology of a developer is almost, if not more important than their ability to their technical ability, I guess. Where would you say now your journey, obviously managing and director now of your own company, what would you say is the next peak for you to go on to?
So now I think I'm at the bottom of one of these curves.
Yeah, sure.
I've done this once before with lots of white hair and lots of stress. Learned a lot of things not to do. Like to do it again. That's what I want to do. And that's why I've set up this consulting company as well, to help people who want to talk about psychology of development, psychology of their organizations. And if you like what I've said and you want to talk.
Yeah, by all means.
Reach out to me.
I picked up on it. I can't remember if I mentioned it earlier. It was the last time we spoke, but the translation of the name of your business. Just tell the listeners.
It's called Kova, which of course Irish word is unpronounceable to anyone but the Irish. It can be.
Apologies for my pronunciation at the start if I got it wrong.
It can be roughly translated as empathy.
Yeah.
It can mean working together. It can mean all sorts of things like that. But it's in the region of empathy.
That's brilliant. I mean, I think that's probably one of my favorite names of a company I've ever heard, because I'm a strong one for empathy. I think it's really important to understand when you're talking to someone where they're coming from and what they might be, how they might be viewing
it. That's what you have to do. Yeah,
exactly. It's perspective, isn't it? You have to understand a problem before you can even go about trying to fix it. Mm. But I guess that's our time, Damien. I think I'll thank you immensely for coming on and giving us your time. It's been really, really a great, honest, open chat about psychology. You know, we don't always talk about it, do we? I think it's important to share, have open and honest conversations, and hopefully, I guess, off the back of this, anyone's listening and has a conversation about anything that they're struggling with. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be something you're struggling with. Talk about what you're enjoying. You know, it's equally as important, right? So is there any last final words, Damien, you'd like to say?
This world is very tough, particularly now. This is kind of the first recession or almost recession that a lot of people have ever gone through in their lives.
Well, I mean, we made it an hour and 15 minutes without using the word recession. I think we deserve a pat on the back.
Had to get it in there. But the important thing is that, you know, being kind to each other. Mm. It's difficult. And when times are difficult, you need to remember that there is only kindness.
Yeah.
And being kind to ourselves is also just as important.
And understanding.
It's going to be tough. Yeah.
Understanding what kindness means, that we spoke about it earlier, not being just nice all the time, but being kind. I think that's probably a great way to finish. So Damien, thank you so much for your time. I'll speak to you soon, no doubt. And enjoy the rest of your week. And thanks very much for joining us here at the Godel Pod.
Thanks so much, Michael.
No worries. Take care.